Good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this our 13th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the white, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster, Haiwan Wan. Daniel Peach and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Eric Fisher. Our speaker tonight is a native of Santiago, Chile, where her mother was an educator and her father an economist. She was exposed to the world at an early age, attending elementary schools in the United States, Pakistan, Chile, and Argentina, and high schools in Argentina, Colombia, and the United States. She was influenced by her paternal grandfather, who was an amateur historian, and impacted by the poverty she witnessed as a child in places like Pakistan. While attending Harvard, where she earned a bachelor's degree, magna cum laude, in history and literature, she became interested in Latin American history while taking classes from John Womack, famed historian of the Mexican Revolution. Transferring to Yale, she received her M.A., M.Phil., and Ph.D. Her teaching career has taken her from the Universidad Nacional Agraria La Molina in Lima, Peru, to Marquette, Yale, and the University of Wisconsin, where she remains passionately dedicated to teaching, and from which she received the university's M.L.H. Steiger's Distinguished Teaching Award in 1995. In 2006, she was named the Julietta Kirkwood Professor of History, and in 2010, she became department chair. Her particular interests are modern Latin America, gender, ethnicity and class, and indigenous history. Her first book, The Defense of Community in Peru's Central Highlands, Peasant Struggle and Capitalist Transition, 1860 to 1940, was published in 1983 and was an honorable mention for the Bolton Prize. In 1995, she received the Bryce Wood Award from the Latin American Studies Association for her book, Peasant and Nation, The Making of Postcolonial Mexico and Peru, published by the University of California Press. Her two most recent monographs, When a Flower is Reborn, The Life and Times of a Mapuche Feminist, and Courage Tastes of Blood, The Mapuche Community of Nicolas, Ayo, and the Chilean State, 1906 to 2001, were published by Duke University Press in 2002 and 2005. She's received both a Guggenheim and Fulbright Fellowship. 9 years ago, she became interested in writing fiction, and after attending workshops in Iowa and Nebraska, she's penned her first novel, Beyond the Ties of Blood, published in 2012 by Pegasus, which has drawn international acclaim and even comparison to the works of famed Chilean novelist Isabel Allende. It's a powerful love story played out against the turmoil of Chile's 1973 military coup, which overthrew the democratic government of Salvador Allende and replaced it with a brutal dictatorship. The novel was recently featured on NBC Latino on June 19th and is the subject of her talk tonight. Please give a warm welcome to Florencia Mallon. Florencia?
Thank you for that extremely generous introduction. I want to thank Brian Kutz, Christopher McConnell, Peggy Wright, and all the other people at WKU and Barnes & Noble who arranged my visit. It is indeed a pleasure to be with you this evening. I teach history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but more important for this novel, I was born in Santiago, Chile, and like a main character, spent a good part of my life between the United States and Latin America. Through the eyes of five strong women, my novel explores the convulsions faced by Chilean society between the presidency of socialist Salvador Allende between 1970 and 73, and the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. A family saga that explores lives further back in time, my novel also provides historical context on Chile between the 1930s and the present day. I will start with two excerpts that introduce the two main characters whose love story forms the backbone of the narrative. Eugenia Aldunate, an upper-class Chilean woman who is now starting the university in Santiago in the early part of the Allende government, and Manuel Bronstein, who is from a family of Jewish immigrants from the south of Chile, from Temuco, and who is a radical student activist. They meet at a demonstration, and they form a bond that becomes the center of the story. Once I've done reading these two excerpts, I would then be happy to take questions or continue reading other sections if that seems preferable.
Cooking and childbearing, then at least you can pronounce my name right. E like invest, she heard herself say. Then u he, the e is like best again. Ni a, e u he ni a. But then she'd remember the struggles with her journalism students who couldn't pronounce her last name Aldunate to save their skins. Finally, she just accepted being called Professor A. And so she decided Eugenia, it would remain, even though she cringed a bit inside every time she heard it. It was more than just an issue of pronunciation, however. This had been the story of the whole 5 years since she had moved to the United States from her original exile in Mexico. Every time someone addressed her by this strange-sounding name, a chasm opened up between her experience, her culture, her life, and the world around her. When people commented that with her light brown curly hair and blue eyes, she certainly didn't look Latin, at first she had tried to explain that not all Latins looked alike, that color was a question of social class, and that most Latins in the United States were economic refugees rather than political refugees like her. When she repeatedly received confused and disinterested looks in return, she finally gave up. After every interaction that involved her name or her coloring, a wave of longing would come over her, and for a moment she was sure she would die if she didn't see the sunset over the Pacific Ocean, the brilliant blue of the Chilean sky, or the alabaster majesty of the Andes on a winter morning. But she also knew that she lived in a way that would have been impossible in Chile. Her sister Irene, who had been in Boston a lot longer than she had, lived openly with her girlfriend Amanda. Neither sister felt the pressure to find a man, with the right last name, of course, and have the abundant grandchildren that would have sealed their mother's prestige among her friends. Yet they were still bound to their world of origin with invisible strings. Irene returned to Chile every year to spend her Christmas break, which was during the Chilean summer, at their family's country house. Last year, Amanda had complained about being left alone over the holidays once again. Every year, when Irene got back, she reported to Eugenia that although their mother knew that as a political exile, her other daughter could not return, she still complained bitterly about being abandoned. And even though Eugenia knew it was silly, she always felt guilty. She tried to raise her daughter differently. She wanted to give Laura enough room to develop freely without the burden of constant judgment. So she let her stay out late and go to parties at a much earlier age than she had ever done herself. Then she saw bruises on her daughter's neck. Only 15 and already making out with boys. But when she remembered her mother's clinging, spying, and wheedling, she bit her tongue. Still, she was never sure she was doing the right thing. She felt that chasm again between how she and her sister had grown up and what seemed normal in her daughter's world. Eugenia opened her mailbox and took out the thick envelope with red and white stripes along the edges. Across the front was her name and university address in a spiky, self-assured script that was unfamiliar to her. Looking up at the return address, she saw, in official-looking cursive, the name and address of the new Truth Commission in Santiago. Above it, almost on the fold of the envelope itself, was written in the same unusual script of the address. I, Pérez. Ah, yes, Ignacio Pérez. That was the name of the lawyer who had called her the other day. Ripping open the envelope with trembling hands, she found a series of documents which she presumed were sent to all potential witnesses. A small handwritten note was attached in identical spiky handwriting. "These are the basic rules of testifying," it said. "Look them over carefully, and if you feel you cannot follow the guidelines, please write to me at the commission. Otherwise, I suggest you begin trying to remember things in systematic order, perhaps through a journal. We have found with other witnesses we have contacted that this helps a lot. Unless I hear from you otherwise, I will see you in about 3 months. Ignacio." Eugenia knew it would be hard to understand the bureaucratic language and the rules, but Irene had worked in the human rights movement and could help her figure it out. She put the sheets back in the envelope, returned it to her mailbox, and retraced her steps out of the building. She took the brick pathway diagonally across the quadrangle to the student grocery store, where she picked out a blank book with lined pages, a pack of Galois cigarettes, and a large, fresh orange. Then she went back to her office, locked the door behind her, and sat down at her desk. She lit a black tobacco cigarette, peeled the orange, and closed her eyes. Manuel's scent surrounded her, and for a moment, he was in the room. With all the lights off in her office except the desk lamp and no classes or office hours to get in the way, she opened her new journal and allowed herself to remember. Santiago, 1971. She careened off the bus at the Plaza Baquedano, trying unsuccessfully to straighten her brown leather jacket in the crush of college students. Once the herd had stampeded by, she stood for a moment on her own facing the statue and wondered how in the world she would find Sergio in this crowd. Already the tide of humanity swelled in all directions. Jostled back and forth by a new wave of dark-haired demonstrators, she felt her right ankle give way as the thin heel of her boot caught the edge of a cobblestone, pushing her down on one knee. Another young woman stopped to help her up, then strode off on sturdy hiking boots, hands free of bags or packages. As she watched the other girl disappear into the crowd, Eugenia realized she was overdressed yet again. She was trying so hard to fit in. She found her bomber-style jacket at one of the secondhand stores that were sprouting up all over the neighborhood near her university, building the demand among her classmates for more worn-in hippie styles. With the slightly faded jeans and black turtleneck, she was sure she'd hit the right note. But the boots were still too fancy, and they weren't good on the uneven cobblestones. She wished for the 100th time that Sergio had been willing to agree on a place to meet. "It'll be easy," he'd assured her vaguely. "Not that many people will show up before the afternoon." She had to admit he'd been more and more evasive recently. She'd lost count of the number of times he had kept her waiting for more than an hour. True, it was barely 10 in the morning, and they'd agreed to meet at 10:30, but it was an unusually hot fall day, and the place was overflowing. She could already feel a thin rivulet of sweat dripping down the middle of her back. All around her, the scent of young, unwashed bodies, musty underarms combined with the stench of days-old socks, mingled with cheap black tobacco and the occasional forbidden sweetness of marijuana. From the corner of her eye, she caught the fluttering of a red and black revolutionary flag hanging from the nose of the Baquedano statue's horse. Ironic, she thought, that General Manuel Baquedano, whom she knew from her history textbooks as yet another generic 19th century military hero from the War of the Pacific, should have his horse insulted in this way. This brought her attention more fully to the center of the plaza and to the three young men who seemed to be leading the chants. As she looked, two of them, sporting Che Guevara-like berets, descended the stairs of the monument and fanned out among the masses, holding bundles above their heads that looked like leaflets to give out. The single figure left at the top of the stairs held a megaphone in his right hand while his left fist waved in the air with each chant. As he climbed further up to the base of the statue, the crowd roared with approval. He turned his back on her to whip up enthusiasm on the other side of the plaza, and a blaze of light hurtled through his red curls. Ricocheting through the crowd, it shone directly in her eyes. She stood waiting near the statue, shifting her weight from right to left, feeling the edge of her left boot rub sharply against her instep, hoping Sergio would show up quickly and end her humiliation. Instead, a group of folk singers in black ponchos moved forward and set up their microphones against the side of the statue. As they took out their bongos and guitars and began their first set, the red-haired student put down his megaphone and went slowly down the stairs. He collapsed against the wrought iron fence at the bottom, supporting his weight on his lower back. Eugenia moved closer. "Excuse me," she said, "compañero." He pushed his shoulders back as he straightened up. "Compañera." She shifted her weight back from left to right, trying to take the pressure off her left instep. She cleared her throat. "I couldn't help noticing you were leading the crowd from up there, so I thought I..." He leaned slightly sideways, right elbow resting casually on the fence. "It's just that I was supposed to..." "Do you know Sergio Undurraga?" she finally blurted out. He sat down on the ledge of the closest flower bed, shoulders hunched forward once again. "Look, compañera, everyone knows Sergio, but he's not here yet." She held out her right hand. "Eugenio Dunate, it's just that he was supposed to meet me here at 10:30. "Manuel Bronstein," he answered, standing up once again. He took Eugenia's hand in his much larger one. "No offense, compañera, but anyone who knows Sergio knows he won't be here until at least 1 o'clock, longer if he runs into a cute pair of legs along the way." She jerked her hand from his grasp and turned to go. "Wait, I'm sorry, I didn't mean..." She stopped, her back still toward him. "Oh yes, you did. Do I look that stupid?" He hurried after her and grabbed her shoulder. "No, I'm sorry, I really am. Look, truth is, well, we're from different groups, different campuses. You know, opposite sides of the river." She turned to look at him and his hand fell slowly to his side. "Okay, look, I'm just angry because me and the guys from the University of Chile were always the ones left holding the bag. The guys from the socialist youth at the Catholic University claim to be such radicals, but they can't get up before noon." They were standing about 50 feet from the plaza's southern edge. The crowd had thinned out around them as people pressed in to try and get a glimpse of the singers. Eugenia felt the full weight of the sun bearing down on her head. As she reached up a hand to wipe the sweat gathering at the top of her eyebrows, she noticed a line of smaller, coiled-up ringlets along Manuel's forehead. His abundant red hair and beard would not have been unusual at the Catholic University, where many of the upper-class students were light-skinned, even blonde. But they did stand out in the more working-class crowd at the University of Chile. And his eyes, she noticed, were a stormy shade of gray. Still, his hair was slightly ragged along the edges, a clear sign he didn't have the money for a professional haircut. She brought her hand down and looked away. "It's kind of hot, isn't it?" he said, looking down at his watch. "I don't come back on for another hour and a half or so. You want to find a cold drink somewhere?" Without waiting for an answer, he put his hand under her elbow and led her off toward the line of juice shops that hugged the sidewalk along Providencia Avenue. Eugenia let herself be carried along. He stopped at the third one down from the corner and claimed a table under the red awning. After pulling out a chair for her, he went inside. When he emerged a few minutes later, he sat down next to her, stretched his long legs under the table so that his boots peeked out on the other side, and smiled. "I hope you don't mind, but I went ahead and ordered for both of us. I know the guy behind the counter, and he makes a mean grape juice. It's fresh, and don't worry, he boils the water." He laughed. I learned the hard way, believe me. Several cases of the runs before I figured out that a lot of the guys around here must use sewer water in their drinks. A young man in a white waiter's jacket stained with what looked like the remains of strawberry juice put two tall glasses down in front of them, thick white straws floating diagonally across their rims. Eugenia's mother had always warned her about drinking water at restaurants closer to downtown, fearing that the water supply outside the more upscale neighborhoods could not be trusted. She was grateful for the reassurance and took a sip of the cold liquid. It was delicious. So how is it that you know Sergio anyway? Manuel asked. Is he your boyfriend? She allowed herself to focus on his unkempt hair and beard, the smells of sweat and unwashed clothes mixing with black tobacco, and under it all, a surprising aroma of oranges. Although he acted so cocky and sure of himself, it was a vulnerability to him that gathered in his gray eyes, the set of his shoulders, even the angle of his dirty beret. So this wasn't what a revolutionary student was supposed to look like, she thought. Not like Sergio, with his expensive haircut, custom-made clothes, and imported cigarettes. You're awfully nosy for someone I barely know, she said, bristling a little in spite of herself. He chuckled. Could be. The loud slurping of his straw against the bottom of the glass made clear he had finished his juice in less than a minute. You were pretty thirsty, too. How could you finish it so quickly when you talk so much? Manuel leaned back in his chair. Okay, look, Eugenia. It's just that Sergio isn't a very nice guy, in my opinion. And he's not dependable. You seem like a nice enough person, but I just don't think he's being square with you. Especially if he said to meet you at 10:30, and he looked at his watch. It's already 12, which by the way means I need to pay up and go. He bolted up from his seat and disappeared back into the shop. When he reemerged a couple of minutes later, he threw some coins on the table and put out a hand to help Eugenia up, surprising her with the gentlemanly gesture. Thanks, but I'm not done yet. Let me just sit here and finish my juice. When you're done up there, I'll find you near the statue if I'm still around. You're easy to spot with your red hair. And Manuel, she added as he turned to go, thanks for the drink. He turned back and nodded slightly in her direction, then turned again and disappeared into the crowd. Minutes later, she could see the blaze of his hair as he began to climb the stairs, megaphone in hand. Eugenia sat at the table alone, nursing her sore left foot. She finished her drink slowly, enjoying the coolness of the liquid in the shade. Her foot felt a lot better after a while, though she came to realize how foolish she'd been to wear these boots to a demonstration. She got up from the table and began to walk back toward the plaza. She jumped when she felt a hand grab her arm, and for an instant, she thought she was being robbed. Hey, where have you been? I've been looking all over. It was Sergio. He leaned down to kiss her cheek. Man, what a crowd. Stinks to high heaven around here. You really must have been held up, Eugenia looked at her watch. I got so hot waiting around that I decided to have a drink. Have to be careful around here, babe. The hygiene isn't what you're used to in your neighborhood, you know. It's okay. I had a good guy. He knows the places around here. She met Sergio's quizzical gaze and continued, it's that guy up there with the megaphone. Manuel Bronstein from the University of Chile? Sergio spluttered. You know who he is? He's one of the top guys in the revolutionary left. He's from the South, Temuco, I think. Word is he had to come up here because the cops were after him. Not the kind of guy you want to invite to your house for dinner, little girl. Family's been in the country one, maybe two generations. No land to speak of. Man, I can just see your mama's face when he gets to the door. Red beard and all, reeking of black tobacco and garlic. Nicotine stains on his broken fingernails. Believe me, Doña Isabel would faint at the sight. Eugenia straightened up to her full height and wrenched her elbow free. You can say whatever you want, but there's a few things I know for sure without your help. He was here early. He and his friends did all the work to get things going. He was thoughtful enough to see I was hot. He offered me a juice, making sure we went to the place that boiled its water. By the time you showed up, you were 2 hours late, as usual. And even if your imported Marlboros smell a lot better than his black tobacco, the stench of your patronizing attitude makes me want to throw up. She turned and headed for the plaza. Surprised at her own assertiveness and at how happy she felt that it was finally over with Sergio. It had been a long time in coming, but it took that drink with Manuel for her to finally realize it for herself. So I think I'll take a break from her story there. I want to read a bit also from Manuel's story, which is the next chapter, but I also feel that I want to be attentive to questions or desires from the crowd, if you'd rather that I continue reading until I get to the scene where he finally decides it's time to seduce her and then has a real surprise. I could do that, or I could go on to read from his story, which is when he, it starts when he is in the torture camp, but goes back to his childhood in Temuco. So you want the seduction story first, or you want the torture story first? What a question. Yeah, what? Seduction? Torture. How many tortures in the audience? Okay. And how many seductions? It's about even. I'll read a short little piece from the seduction scene, and then I'll move on to the other one, just to make sure that we have a bit of each. So let me just explain how we get to the seduction scene. So after she tells Sergio to get lost, she goes back and stays near the statue until he's done speaking, and he comes down and they start to talk, and he invites her back to the same place where they're going to have a sandwich, and he orders some red wine and starts to get her drunk, and you know, starts to kind of, you know, this is kind of cool, and I'm like this big socialist leader, and don't you think I'm cool, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And so they're sitting at the restaurant, and let's see. Okay, here we go. The thick cherry-toned Cabernet was like a soft blanket against the evening chill. Manuel ordered another bottle when they finished the first one, and pretty soon they were sitting very close together, her head on his shoulder, both smoking black tobacco cigarettes. "I don't know what I'm going to do when I get home," she said, the unfamiliar roughness of the cigarette stinging her tongue slightly. "My mother will smell the black tobacco a mile away." She took another puff anyway, savoring the peppery aftertaste. "One possible solution is that you don't go home until it wears off." He was now running his free hand through her soft ringlets. "Somehow, I think not going home at all isn't going to solve the problem," she said, nudging him away playfully. "You can't blame a guy for trying." He let go of her hair and his hand dropped slightly to her jawline, gently bringing her head closer. They kissed. The hairs of his beard were surprisingly soft, and he tasted of burnt oranges. Her cigarette lay abandoned in the ashtray. "So what do you think we should do?" he asked finally, his voice hoarse. "I don't know, but one thing is clear. Sergio is going to find a way to tell her." Manuel sighed, and his chair scraped loudly as he pulled back, fumbling in the crushed pack for another cigarette. "What do you mean?" "Well, he's my mama's favorite from a good family. They have land right next to ours. He's not very happy right now, I'm sure of it, and he's going to find a way to get back at me. What better way than to tell my mother about you?" Removing the cigarette from the pack and scrabbling around in the matchbox helped him regain his composure. She wasn't exactly sure what had upset him most, her suggestion that he wasn't from a good family or her bringing up Sergio. After lighting it and blowing out a cloud of smoke, his voice had recovered its ironic tinge. No offense, but what were you doing with him anyway? Our family saw each other every summer vacation since I can remember. He was the handsome older boy next door. When I started at the Catholic University this year, his mama said to watch out for me. It felt like everything was already decided, you know? He's a big-time leader, all my girlfriends were jealous, I don't know. Tell me the truth, did you know he was running around on you? It's not like I thought about it consciously, but when you said that before, I wasn't surprised, just offended that you'd said it to me. I guess I didn't want to admit it to myself, and hearing it from someone else set me off. You're right, I was acting like, it's okay, never mind. Manuel stubbed out his cigarette and stood up, pulling her up and into his arms. His kiss was deeper, longer. She felt the tingle on the inside of her lips move down her body until it became a weakness in her knees. When it was over, she leaned into him, resting her head against the middle of his chest. I live right here, just on the other side of the river, he whispered. Come back with me for a few minutes, then I'll find you a taxi. They walked across the plaza and through the park, stopping to kiss again under a weeping willow. As they strolled down the bridge, across the bridge, their arms around each other, the Mapocho River caught the reflection of the rising moon. On the other side of the river, Manuel put a key in the lock of a tiny door next to a dry cleaning shop. They climbed up a flight of dark, narrow stairs. Inside the apartment, he turned and crushed her in his arms, not even bothering to close the door at first. His lips left a line of fire along the curve of her right breast, fire spreading, gathering, knotting. Soon they were lying on his unmade bed, his hands hot on her bare skin, not able finally to get close enough, soon enough. They were still too far apart, and then the pain. She gasped and drew back. What in the hell? His voice was suddenly very far away. And then so was he. She sat up. You hadn't, he hadn't. Why in the hell didn't you say something? He bolted up from the bed and was already zipping up his pants. Then he began pacing back and forth. She was silent at first. What's the matter? She finally asked. Why in the hell didn't you say something? You mean because I'm a virgin? Well, yeah. Why wouldn't I be? It's 1971. Come on. She began picking up her clothes. No matter how hard she tried, she'd never be part of this radical crowd. Her eyes filled with tears, and she wasn't sure if it was from anger or from shame. What was the point anyway? But then he sat down on the bed next to her. Wait a minute, stop. He took both of her hands in his. Look at me just a moment. She refused to look up, not wanting him to see the tears. She focused on trying to zip up her boots. I'm sorry, he said. To be honest, it was quite a surprise. I know, I should have said something, but, well, it happened kind of fast. I never let Sergio go that far. I don't know. I didn't want to stop. She stood up and walked to the window, finally able to zip up her jeans and put her jacket back on. She stood by the window looking out at the moonlit street, the leaves of early fall swirling in eddies around the abandoned cobblestones. She rested her forehead on the pane. I didn't want to stop either. He was standing right behind her, running a hand along her neck. She melted back into him, then turned into his embrace. He drew away first. But it won't be like this, not the first time. Let's find you a taxi. So that's essentially the seduction scene. That's the moment when they seem to connect. And she begins to wonder if part of the reason she fell in love with him was because he was such a gentleman, because he didn't take advantage of her and knew that she was different, that she was not from the radical crowd. So that's the end of the way in which they begin to connect. And then their story, of course, evolves and develops over the rest of the Allende years. So, do we still have time for the torture? Well, there's no real torture in it, but it's when he's in the torture camp. And this is from Manuel's point of view. This opens up the story of him. I'm going to have to get a little water. This is the second chapter. It's called Taking a Stand. He must have dozed off for a moment. As he startled awake, the pain was a rusty knife gouging through the top of his right shoulder. He tried to move away from it, but then it started down his right side into his hip. He found that if he lay quietly, as still as he could, it returned to his shoulder and seemed to calm down just a bit. As always happened in the dank, windowless cell, Manuel felt the sun begin to rise, a slight warming of the air around him. He thought back, had it been yesterday, to the moment they brought him into the room where Eugenia was, where he managed to look at her with his one good eye. Her face was purple and swollen, dirty tear tracks down her cheeks, and she sat bent over, trying not to put weight on any sore part of her body. The beatings hadn't left her much chance of finding a comfortable position. And what else had they done to her? How stupid he'd been, and how arrogant. She'd never been much of an activist. When did he expect to inform the soldiers she wasn't involved? Before they beat him senseless? After they shocked him unconscious with bolts of electricity? They would release her then, of course. We apologize for the confusion. We only meant to torture your boyfriend. But still he managed to look at her, somehow to will her eyes to meet his one open one. And with all his remaining strength, he tried to talk through his pain and hers, brain to brain, blood to blood. "I'm sorry," he shouted inside his head. "Whatever they've done to you, whatever happens, I'll always love them." The uselessness of his words had echoed through his heart. Now in the early dawn, in the dark closeness of his cell, the echoes returned. When had his ideals turned into this? Temuco, 1963. The late model Oldsmobile sedan gleamed navy blue in the mid-afternoon sun. Manuel circled the back end of the car on his way to the driver's side. The driver's door swung open just before he reached it, and a tall man stood at attention before him. The chauffeur must have been tracking him in the rearview mirror. "Niño Manuel," he said, "please step back on the curb. I'll open the back door for you." Manuel stepped back onto the sidewalk. After the chauffeur opened the back door of the car, he waited politely for a minute or so, then spoke again in a carefully burnished baritone. "You can get in now, Niño Manuel." "No, Francisco, that won't be necessary. I'm going to my grandparents' shop again. In fact, you can tell Papa I won't be needing the car at all this week." Nodding politely, no change of expression on his face, Francisco walked around to his own side and got in, started the car, and pulled away from the curb. Manuel watched him disappear around the corner. He turned and walked a block in the opposite direction, past the intricate wrought iron gate that framed the tasteful entrance to his school, past the queue of chauffeur-driven cars waiting to pick up his schoolmates, past the sugar-sweet aromas that emanated from the rose garden hidden behind the school wall. As he turned left at the corner and began the five-block hike to the city's main avenue, he recalled yet again how dramatically his life had changed since they'd moved to their new house. He'd spent the first decade of his life on a tiny street a block long that ran diagonally between two small parks, right off the main boulevard in Temuco's oldest immigrant neighborhood. The chubby, ruddy-faced woman who cleaned, washed, and cooked for them during the day would go home when his mama came back for tea. Mama would read him stories or trot behind him in the park as he learned to ride a tricycle and then a bicycle all by himself. Papa was even busier at his bakeries on weekends, so when it was sunny, Mama would take them to the park that overlooked the city and they'd have lunch in the small sandwich shop, and she'd buy him an apricot ice cream for dessert. On rainy weekends, they'd visit her parents at their tailor shop, but Mama and Grandma Miriam would usually get into a fight. Almost always it was about the same thing. Why didn't his papa come over too? Why didn't he spend time with his family? Why was he always at the bakery? When Grandma made some comment about how making money wasn't the most important thing in the world, the visit would end suddenly as his mother took him by the arm, putting his wet overcoat back on, the drops of rain from the umbrellas pelting him on the nose as she opened them back up on the way out the door. One day, about a month short of his 10th birthday, Manuel was out in the park when his mama came home. He ran up to her, his brand new friend in tow. "Mama," he asked, "can Marcelo have tea with us?" Mama had looked the other boy up and down, her glance lingering over his scuffed shoes, the hole in his sweater right below the left elbow, the old dirt and snot stains on his cheeks. "Not today, Manuelito," she'd said after a short silence. "Maybe another day." There'd never been another day. He'd asked her about it a couple of times, but her answer was always vague, and she always managed to change the subject. When he'd wanted to invite Marcelo to his birthday party, Mama had murmured something about keeping it in the family. They celebrated with Mama and Papa, Grandma Miriam, and Grandpa David. Several weeks later, he'd come home from the park to find both parents at home, a special tea time snack ready, their faces shining with anticipation. His mama gave him a hug, and Papa beamed encouragement from his place at the head of the table. "Manuelito, dear, we have some wonderful news," she began. "We found a wonderful new house. It's at least 3 times bigger than this one. You'll have your own room, study, and bathroom, almost like your own apartment. The yard is huge. You won't even have to go out to the park to ride your bike." "Yes," his papa chimed in, the remnants of his childhood German still echoing in his accent. "The yard, it is so large. You can invite all of the children in the neighborhood over. They all fit to play soccer. We build the goalposts if you want." "And Manuelito," his mother added, "will be so near that wonderful new school I've been wanting for you, and they give preference to people in the neighborhood. So yesterday when I went by and explained about our new house to the headmistress, she went right ahead and signed your acceptance papers." And she petered off in mid-sentence as she got a glimpse of his shocked face. "What's the matter, Niñito?" "But I don't want to move. I'm happy here." His papa had cut him off. "It is better in the new house. Many children live on the street from families more like us. In school too, you'll be happier there." Manuel knew that Papa meant it as a promise, but it had sounded like an order. And so Manuel had begun attending Temuco's newest and most expensive private school with a reputation for progressive learning methods. It was so different from his other school, a public one that welcomed all the children who had lived nearby, no matter how much money their parents made. The children of all the best families, the ones whose parents had the largest farms and the biggest lumber mills, went to this new school. They all lived in the same neighborhood, too, the one with streets named after European countries. Like all the other mothers in her new social circle, Sara Weiss de Bronstein was now too busy with her charity work and her Tuesday canasta games to pick her son up from school or take him to the park. But unlike the other children, he refused to be picked up by his father's new chauffeur-driven car.
Questions? Well, I might start off with one, and how does the historian become a novelist?
Not easily.
Not easily.
Well, I'd like to say that there are two ways in which it happens. One is if you're a novelist first and then you become a historian and then you decide maybe you want to be a novelist again. That's kind of, I mean, I started off wanting to be a writer, a fiction writer. I wrote a lot of poetry when I was in high school. I ran the literary magazine at my high school. And then when I went to college, I got caught smack in the middle of the Vietnam War protests. And I was radicalized. I became, I got tear gas, I got arrested, the whole deal. And when that happened, I found that I lost my voice. The things that were going on, I didn't have a voice to talk about, so I couldn't write fiction anymore. And then I started taking courses in history, and I thought, oh good, here's a narrative already formed. Oh good, here are sources I can use that tell a story. I don't have to come up with it all by myself. And so I became a historian. And I like it. I liked it a lot then, I like it a lot now. But at some point, I found that it wasn't enough, that I had to go back to try to write fiction. And that's what the second piece of it is, which is that there, okay, this may sound kind of weird. If it does, please let me know. But there's an Italian, oral historian who's also a literary critic by the name of Alessandro Portelli. And one of the things that he wrote that I found to be really, really interesting was he said, oral history is different from written history, and in that sense it's sort of more narrative, more personal. Because when someone remembers something one way, and then you find out in the sources, in the written sources, that it actually happened a really different way, what you have is an opportunity to move from fact to truth. And, you know, a lot of people who are historians feel that the two things are the same, you know, that something isn't true unless you have the documents to be able to prove it. But I got to the point when I was doing history work where the two things weren't always the same. Often they were, but sometimes they weren't, because I couldn't prove something, I didn't have the documentation, but there was a part of me that felt that it was definitely true and that I needed to explore it through other means. And that's really where writing fiction for me has come from that place where I can't quite tell a story with footnotes. And yet I know it's a story that needs to be told. And I know that at some very basic level it's true. So those are my two answers.
I really like the way you use time in your novel. You bring all these events in the next and in a chronicle way, but you re-bring them later on, and it takes a totally different shape and perspective, which made me think that it's not really brought from the history side, but more it looks like brought from memory, you know, how events come to your memory in different times. There's things that trigger them. Can you comment about that?
Well, the part of it that maybe I can comment the most on, and then if I haven't really done a complete job, you can ask the other part again if you'd like. But I guess that it's true that there are parts of what I write in fiction in terms of moving around from one point of view to another, trying to give different points of view on the same set of events, right, and seeing the way in which different people perceive them differently. That does come from my experience with people's memory of events, whether it's when I did oral history for my research in Chile, I talked with people who had survived torture, who had been arrested, and so on. And so talking with them about those experiences really helped me to understand how individual perspective really changes the way in which you understand an event and the way in which you remember it. And so part of what I wanted to do in the novel was to show some of that. I think at the same time that given my own family background, given the fact that many of the people in my Chilean family supported the coup, that I always had huge arguments with a number of people in my family about Chilean politics, and the fact that my family was very angry at the kind of history that I did because they felt that it was I was betraying the family because of the kind of history that I did. I felt the need both to note that and to write about it, but also to do it in a way that didn't make anyone into just a horrible villain. You know, in fiction, it's really hard to do that and keep your audience unless it's a detective story where there are villains who you want to be delicious villains, right? But you know, I think that in a lot of fiction, you really want to be able to be empathetic with most of the characters, even if you know that some of them are not very, very nice people. You want to understand their human motivations. So I guess that would be the other piece of it. And that really did help me to understand the motivations of my family. That was a journey for me in this novel, was to understand the motivations of women in my Chilean family.
Other questions? You write a lot about food and drink in this book. Is this something that you have a particular interest in, or more so than most novels do?
Well, you know, I think part of that has to do with the fact that there are certain foods and certain tastes that have a real strong connection with particular moments and particular memories in my life. And so I found that it was something that worked for me in terms of, and also because I wanted people to understand about Chilean food, you know? It's great. What?
No tacos involved? No burritos involved?
No tacos, no burritos, no. No.
She does talk about loco, so does anyone know what a loco is?
It's a shellfish that is sort of like abalone. I don't know if any of you are familiar with abalone shellfish that you can get mainly, it makes sense, right, off the California coast. Right? Because, hey, it's the Pacific, Chile also, right? So, and it's a kind of mollusk meat that is, if you cook it right, and there is a description in the novel about a woman who is cooking locos and takes a stick to them and is beating them, you know, and she says, if you don't beat them well, they never get soft enough. You know, you have to beat them before you cook them, otherwise they get too hard. But they're really soft, and they have this really kind of semi-sweet, semi-nutty flavor that's very unusual. And I found over the years that every time I went back to Chile, right away my family knew that the first thing they had to set on the table for me was locos, because otherwise I'd be so disappointed if I didn't get my locos when I got there. Yeah. A few other things like that.
Back here, yes.
You mentioned that in rallies during the Vietnam War and stuff like that, and they met at rallies. Is there any more rallies like in the story that maybe you use your experience like it?
That's a very good question. There's only that one big demonstration in the novel. There's a lot of other political activity that's going on, and there are other political confrontations in the novel that Manuel is involved in. But I was not really a student in Chile. I was a student in the United States. And so while I certainly did get the sense from my own political activity of what it felt like to be in a large demonstration, that the scene of the demonstration is kind of this combination of my memory of what it meant to be part of a very large crowd at a rally in the United States, and my understanding of the space where those rallies and demonstrations always went on in Santiago, which is at the Plaza Baquedano, also known as the Plaza Italia. Okay, so it's kind of this layered thing, where one part of the experience comes from one thing and the other comes from another.
You partially answered a question a little bit ago that I had in mind, but I wondered if you were living in Chile prior to all of the uproar, and then you had to leave, And then you're looking out back and reliving your life and how it has changed. How did the truth of what happened affect people really historically? Is there, I don't know whether I'm getting it out just right, but when you live in one situation, mm-hmm. and then the turmoil comes and throws everything apart, you are driven out of the country. Sometimes you don't get to know the full truth when you're out of the country. What happens to people when they finally find the truth? Is there any historical? Maybe I'm going too far, but I just feel my heart is broken when I think of these people and the suffering that went on them.
I was in Chile at various points during the Allende government. So, I mean, I did see some of what was happening. I experienced some of the divisions in my own family, in arguments and conversations.
So they wound up being divided even after the entire horrendous murder and all of that.
Well, this was more still during the actual mobilizations under Allende before the coup. Yeah. I certainly, when I went back in the 90s, I talked with a lot of people who had gone through it, who had experienced it in a variety of different ways. I ended up making really good and very close friendships with a number of people who had been arrested and tortured. And I also really got to know the memories from the experience of the people who had mobilized supporting Allende and just the horrible sense of rupture that they had felt at the end. And in fact, when I started to publish things, historical things about this, I only learned later, but a rumor started going around that the only way that I could have possibly have gotten access to all that information must have been because I was in the revolutionary left. Mm. So the rumor went around in the academic world that obviously she's from the revolutionary left, she just has never owned up to the truth. Mm. It's not true, but that's what everyone was sort of rumoring about. So I don't know, I guess that for some reason I was able to listen to stories in ways that allowed people to tell me more and I was able to empathize with them. And I guess the way most of that came out was in fiction. But you know, one of the themes of the novel is the notion of truth. What is the truth? And when you look for the truth, do you really know what you're looking for? And when you find the truth, is it what you thought you were going to find? And what happens if the truth is different from what you wanted it to be?
You know what really prompted the question is, last night we had a speaker from South Africa, and he was imprisoned in South Africa. Any of you guys go? It was absolutely astounding. He is not quite as old as I am. I'm older than God sometimes, I guess. When he came back, he had no bitterness about all of the horror of South Africa. And I suppose maybe that's what prompted it, because that whole situation in Chile was horrendous. And the situation in South Africa was equally so. And for him to come out not angry, he was angry at the government, and yet there was a peace in him, you know, so you don't...
Any further comments? One right here, yeah.
I have heard Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela, so it's a way to move on and to survive, I think. But my question was related to exile, because it comes there on, you know, it's a present topic there. And also the theme of guiltiness and the outsider, all these are there on the novel. So did you feel any guilt by not being there and by being in the United States and not being with the family, with your friends or anything like that, and being part of that part of history?
Yeah. Well, I guess that at a certain level, I really did feel guilty that I was unable to go back and share the experience with some of the people I knew. At the same time, as I said before, you know, most of my family did support the coup. So in terms of family, there really weren't that many people whom I was close to who suffered with the coup. In fact, most of them were happy that it had happened. And what I did at that time was I worked assiduously over the years in the Chilean Solidarity Movement in the United States. The coup happened on, I mean, this is one of the things that's really quite amazing about this is that if you think about Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, and the Twin Towers, September 11th, 1973 was also a Tuesday. And some of the images that you see of the presidential palace going up in flames after it's been bombed, when I saw the Twin Towers, it reminded me of that. You know, it was like, for me, I guess what the reason I bring that up is that one of the things that happened to me with the Chilean coup and with being in the solidarity movement was that I really opened up my vision to the notion that if you personally, in your own culture, your own nation, your own society, suffer a huge trauma, one of the biggest challenges is not to close down and say, no one has ever suffered what we suffer. One of the biggest challenges is to open yourself up and say, this allows me to understand the trauma of other people because I too now have gone through something that is large and big and very, very painful. And the challenge is to allow that to serve as an opening rather than a closing. And that really is what happened to me in the United States and being able to really work in the solidarity movement. And of course, fighting like tooth and nail with my family because they all pretended nothing had happened. They all said, no, almost nobody. No, there weren't, no people were killed. That doesn't happen in Chile. So that those were my battles, really.
And on that note, I think we'll be expressing our thanks to Professor Mayo. And Peggy, a little token of our appreciation to the speaker. I've got you boxed in here.
I know you have. You put me right in.
There we are.
We have this weird custom at Western, and that is, whenever anything happens, we have a red tie. You are only the second person to get this one.
Oh my, I'm honored.
Well, I hope you are, because this is a great university.
That's right. Yeah. We hope when you're in Wisconsin, you'll proudly wave it.
Well, the red gets waved all over Madison on football Saturdays, that's for sure.
And there's just a little surprise in there for you later, you know, when you're all by your lonely. And thank you so much. It's been a fun evening.
Well, thank you all.